So I'm going to call the meeting to order. We had no consideration of a closed session this evening, so there is no Verizon report. So I'd welcome you to stand for O Canada and remain standing for a moment of silent meditation. Thank you. Attendance, Madam Clerk?
We have all in attendance, Your Worship.
Thank you. And approval of the agenda. I'm looking for a mover and seconder to approve the agenda as presented. Councillor Maiden and Councillor Ferguson. All in favor? Thank you. And disclosure of pecuniary interest and general nature thereof, you can make that statement at this time or when the item arrives on the agenda, if that pertains to yourself. And approval of the minutes. These are the minutes dated September 1st, 2020. I'm looking for a mover and seconder to approve the minutes as presented. Councillor Holmes? Councillor Ferguson, thank you very much. All in favor of approval of the minutes? Thank you, the minutes are approved. Which brings us to a delegation from Ms. Sally McIntyre, who is the general manager of the MVCA, who's going to update us on the activities of the Conservation Authority. Welcome.
Thank you very much. So I will get right into it. So thank you very much for allowing me to present to you today. I'm just going to give you a bit of background on myself and where the organization's at, give you also a bit of an update on that water and erosion control infrastructure motion that you people generously adopted, which was much appreciated. Tell you a bit about how that's going to feed into our strategic plan, and then wrap up with a brief discussion about our watershed plan that we've been working on. So a bit of background on me. I joined the organization 18 months ago, and it's been a very full 18 months, I can tell you. So it started off with a brand new board and new members. So Krista and Bev, of course, were two of 10 new members of the board. So we had a big change at the board, as well as a new chair and a vice chair and committee chair. So there was a lot of change even before I was coming on the scene. We also had 4 of 7 members of our senior management team retire, so there was a huge amount of knowledge that walked out of the building at the same time as I was walking in. So that presented challenges. As well, we had the 2019 flood, which everybody here experienced in their own way. We also then, it happened that the province decided to introduce some changes to our legislation, the Conservation Authorities Act, and then quickly following on, they announced that they were giving us a 50% cut in our annual operating levy that they provide to us. And there are more changes on the horizon as they develop implementing regulations under the Act. So it's been a very full year, but I think myself and the organization has responded very well. So first off, thank you very much for endorsing that motion that you addressed about a month or so ago now. It's as it said in the motion, we were very disappointed not to get any funding from the province, and there are structural issues with that program. And you were one of nine municipalities here that have now endorsed that, and RVCA, the Rideau Valley Conservation Authority, has shared it with their member municipalities because this issue is not unique to Mississippi Valley. And Mayor Ron Higgins from North Frontenac is sort of leading the charge and is trying to arrange for meetings with the ministers. And I'm going to hopefully be connecting with him tomorrow to get an update on that. But he had hoped to meet with them within the next couple of weeks and potentially have other municipalities participate with him in that. So the two major capital projects that we're working on, that we are looking for funding for, are the rebuilds of both the Shabamika Lake Dam and Kashwakamak Lake Dam. And they're in the very upper watershed. So they're north of Charbot Lake area. In the scheme of things, they're not big dams, but as you would know, something doesn't need to be very big to be very expensive. So that's the situation. You can see the prices there. And traditionally, the province has funded 50% of those. So you can imagine if we don't get our 50% from them, then, you know, we're having to look elsewhere. And as our primary funders are their municipalities, I thank you entirely for, you know, adopting that motion because it has a potential direct impact on yourselves. So, but it did raise into question in our minds, if we can't rely on the province for that 50% share on capital renewal, we need to rethink our capital program and what's the implications of that on the organization. And so we've just in the past few weeks been looking very closely at our finances. Where do we stand as an organization? How much do we have in reserves? Do we have borrowing capacity? What would that look like? What impact would borrowing have on the municipal levy as opposed to just trying to straight fund things? And so we presented last week to the Finance Committee, and we're presenting to our board tomorrow some initial findings regarding that, with the goal of developing a three-year interim financial plan that helps the board to help staff identify priorities and how do we want to manage this going forward, because it's something we're going to have to grapple with as you grapple with, right? With your capital planning, you got to stage things, you got to figure out how you're going to plan them. So we're in the exact same boat, and this would be our first three-year plan. Currently, most conservation authorities don't do three-year plan budgeting, but I'm proposing that we move in that direction so that we can sort of map out financially where we want to go. And this is, of course, going to tie in very closely to a strategic planning initiative that we were supposed to have started last year, but for all those reasons I described to you, just didn't happen last year. Just was not meant to be. So now, post-COVID, quasi-COVID, we're hoping to embark on our strategic plan this fall. So some of the key inputs to the strategic plan are this interim financial plan that I'm going to be discussing with our board, as well as the Mississippi River Watershed Plan, and I'll be coming back to that in more detail. Some other things you may not be aware, but even though we're called the Mississippi Valley Conservation Authority, we actually have jurisdiction over the Carp River watershed, which comprises a large swath of Kanata and Stittsville in the city of Ottawa, as well as the waterfront on the Ottawa River, where it straddles those two watersheds. So that watershed plan was done several years ago now. We're also doing an environmental scan to see, you know, what's working, what's not working, what the within the organization, and what are some of the variables we need to be thinking about. So certainly what's happening in Mississippi Mills and some of the issues that you may raise to us will feature into our strategic plan. So as we move through this process, we will definitely be coming back to municipalities and saying, you know, what are issues you see from your perspective as a partner with MVCA, and what issues are there that you need to make us aware of that maybe we haven't identified when we're doing our environmental scan. And so we're going to also be obviously looking at our historic strategic plans to see what progress we've made and how we may want to pivot from that direction to where we need to be going as an organization, given all this, you know, flux that we find ourselves in. And then, of course, there's the input of the board members and where strategically they think we need to be going as an organization. So now I'm just going to delve into the watershed plan and give you a bit background on the watershed itself, and then how I see the watershed plan as being a key document to our strategic planning initiative, as well as to our relationship with Mississippi Mills and all the other municipalities in the watershed. So I'm going to start by talking to you about the watershed itself. This is a view that very few people see of the watershed. Normally, you're looking down at a map that has a nice outline of the watershed, and we say, yes, that area drains into the river. What this profile view shows you is how much the elevation changes as it moves from the very top of the watershed down to where it discharges in the Ottawa River. It actually drops over 250 meters, over 200 kilometers, and it's draining upstream of Mississippi Lake is 2,000 square kilometers, and that's where our last structure is, you know, in Carleton Place there. So at our last structure, we're trying to control the volume of flow from over 2,000 square kilometers. And then downstream of that, so where we are here, you know, outside of Elmont, is another over 1,000 kilometers. I think it's around another 1,200 square kilometers of land that's draining into the downstream portion of the river. So one of the key things that I want to point out to you here is that those blue bits, which are major lakes where we have control structures, I refer to them as tablespoons, because when it rains or when we have a freshet, you can imagine that any amount of capacity we have in them in terms of storing those flows is actually relatively limited. And at a certain point, that dam is going to be breached, and that water is going to come down. So if you just think of the water cascading, cascading, cascading down the river, it's important to realize that there's only so much storage capacity in the upper watershed, and that to the degree that we're trying to hold back the flow, we're limited then by the residents on those lakes. And we can't drop the elevation in those lakes in advance, because then people don't have water in their lakes, and that presents a whole other problem. So there are constraints to the operation of the watershed. So that's what this is trying to illustrate, as well as some of the key facts. We have 11 structures that we own and operate. Not all of them are big. Some of them, well, a couple of them, are just maybe two or three sizes bigger than this podium. We're talking very small structures. The two OPG facilities, which are at Crotch Lake and High Falls, are the largest ones, and we don't own or operate. Well, we operate them at their direction, because we're on the land and they've contracted to us to operate their dams, but we don't operate in the controlling sense. They say, remove a log, put in two logs, and we do as they say. So, and then the MNRF structures are very much like our own, and some of them are just as small, and are largely non-operated. Like, we operate them in the spring and we operate them in the fall, but they're not very big structures. There are other dams on the watershed, one of which you guys own through your power corporation, as I understand it. And and then the other three are privately owned. So the background documents that we have produced on the watershed plan are statements of fact, and they speak to what we know about the watershed based upon either mapping or Statistics Canada or, you know, inventories that have been conducted by professionals and the like. And we prepared them and released them in the spring at the same time as COVID was unfolding. So they didn't get kind of the pickup and press and interest that we'd really hoped to, because what they do is they help to, you know, give a very clear understanding amongst everybody of what's happening on the watershed and some of the issues that we need to be collectively addressing over time. It's important to note that these documents were circulated to your staff here, and so they do reflect the comments of municipal staff as well as provincial staff. I think we also circulated the feds on some things where they had a particular interest, and we did get feedback from most municipalities, so they should be an accurate representation of what's happening in the watershed. Our intent is to re-release them this fall, because The spring was a write-off. So we're going to re-release them we're going to sort of reinstigate public promotion around the project generally. So the last one in this series, so there's four in total, the last one is called asset management, and that's what I'm going to focus on today, because that's where our infrastructure as a conservation authority intersects with your infrastructure in a real physical sense, and where the importance of our working relationship comes to the fore. So if you look at these three pictures, you'll recall I was saying that dams come in different shapes and sizes. They also come in different forms. So the one in the upper left corner is the Crotch Lake, the High Falls Dam, which is owned by OPG, and that's the biggest dam on the watershed. Unfortunately, conceptually, that's what a lot of people think about and think of when they're talking about our dams. Well, our dams are much like the one on the upper right, which is quite small by comparison. And that's probably one of our larger dams that you're looking at right there. So it's important to realize that we, by comparison to OPG, don't have nearly the same kind of control or the same size of structures. But then there are structures that, in fact, you own and all the other municipalities own, and they come in the form of road crossings. It's because road crossings function just like a dam. They stop impede the flow. To the extent that water is able to get, in this case, through those two culverts. So that those two culverts going under that bridge have a rated flow capacity. And under certain conditions, that capacity is going to be exceeded, and the water will back up behind that road structure. And at some point, it may even overtop it. So though we don't call it a dam, we call it a bridge or a road crossing culvert, it functions the same as a dam. And that's important because when we're doing our floodplain mapping, we're looking at structures exactly like that to understand how those structures are also impacting the watershed and where potential flooding can occur. It's also important because one of the issues we identified in the watershed plan was that when we're talking about private roads in particular, but also municipal roads, but more the private roads, we have instances, and I'm thinking mainly around lakes and the like, where people, their property itself might be outside the floodplain, but their access road isn't. And under the Conservation Authorities Act, that's an issue, because if you don't have safe access under flood conditions to your property, we're regulated to limit the amount that you can develop on your property, because we're trying to mitigate flood risks, people and property, and that includes safe access and egress in the event of a flood. And that could be for your vehicles, that could be for fire, it could be for other emergency vehicles like ambulance, it could be for evacuation purposes. So It's just important to understand that the infrastructure you build is as important to us for floodplain mapping and for the application of our regulation as our own structures are. The other thing then, if we've talked about damming water and our ability to store it or hold it in situ, I'll call it, within the water course. The next thing I want to talk to you about is water conveyance assets. So the most obvious form of conveying water is a river or a creek or the like, right? But we do things to channelize that, like ditches and drains. Ditches being what you're going to see in a residential subdivision or along the side of the roads. The drains being under the Drainage Act, intended to drain agricultural properties. So these also have an impact on flood patterns and flow rates. And as soon as you look at this one, as soon as that water encounters a culvert obviously is also a form of conveyance, but it has a stricture on it, as I discussed in the previous slide regarding dams, in that culvert limits now flow. So to the degree that that culvert does not convey the runoff from this land here, we're going to get flooding occurring. The other thing is sewers and pump stations. So within Elmont here, you have sewers. I don't know if you have a pump station. I don't know. Does anybody in the room know if you have a single pump station? Sewage pump station. Yeah, you do. Okay. So under wet weather conditions, you know, your system has limitations to it. And what we experience in urban areas like Elmont, and I don't know if you've experienced this to date or in 2019, I didn't hear of it happening, but when your sewer system becomes overloaded with water, that can cause basement flooding in backups and the like. And actually, unfortunately, in 2009, when we had a major storm event come through Stittsville, Canada, my basement flooded, for example, right? So it's important to realize that, again, that your municipal infrastructure is also conveying flow during wet weather events. Sewers are very prone to infiltration from the streets. So what's normally pure sewage under a wet weather event is hugely diluted, and you have all this additional flow going through your sewers and entering your pump station, your sewer, your sewage treatment plant. So, and they're all connected, right? So we're trying to do what we can to mitigate impacts on your infrastructure. And so part of that is through trying to find storage throughout the watershed. To the degree that we can keep it out of the ditches, the drains, the sewers, the culverts and everything, really helps to mitigate impacts to people and property in the landscape. So you'll see here that I've identified four approaches. The first one being using natural vegetation, forests, wetlands, et cetera, to absorb the water. And it's amazing but true, but roughly 60% of the water that hits the land through either precipitation, like snow or snow melt, or through rain, stays on the land. In that there is so much natural vegetation and wetlands that most of the water that falls on the land never reaches the Mississippi River. When we do our modeling, we're taking out a whole lot of water just simply because of the vegetation. And that's why I have as the background picture there is that to the degree that we maintain natural systems, you know, natural vegetation does a huge job for us in mitigating what's coming into the river. Of course, there's the lakes and reservoirs, which I've already spoken to. Stormwater facilities, this is an interesting one because up until really the 90s, this wasn't commonly done. Stormwater was just conveyed and discharged into surface water bodies, whether it be a creek or right into a river, without detention, without any sort of form of quality or quantity treatment. Then in the 90s, it was becoming much more common, and currently it's very common. The thing that we need to bear in mind there, though, is that whatever storage facility you're building, in all likelihood, is not going to be able to accommodate every event that's going to hit the landscape. It will be constrained by the piping leading to that stormwater facility, and B, the facility itself will have a constraint in terms of the size of it. So the degree that we can maintain, for instance, wetlands and forest in particular within the periphery of our communities will help to mitigate that first freshet, that first flush that happens and hits the system. So when I look at, for instance, around Elmont and Carlton Place and in outside of Stittsville, Kanata, where they have wetlands, to the degree that we're able to protect those wetlands, they will provide a huge amount of storage capacity that, quite frankly, it's almost financially impossible to replace with constructed stormwater facilities. So then the last thing I have here is low-impact development. And those are those types of things that we can ask developers to do right on individual properties and parcels within their subdivisions, be it, you know, infiltration pits or swales and the like, using, you know, permeable pavement. These various techniques that, you know, modern engineering allows to mitigate the amount of water leaving a property. So these are the sorts of things that we want to engage Mississippi Mills in these kind of discussions going forward. There's other issues as well, but I thought I would focus on these because of the interrelationship between our mandate, which is to try to, you know, protect people and property from flooding and other natural hazards, and land conservation, with your mandate and your desire, obviously, to promote and encourage growth in a safe manner, while protecting the natural values you value as a community. So in terms of the watershed plan, right now we're about midway, that bit in bold where I'm saying we're completing a discussion paper now. So we've identified all these issues. Now we got to figure out collectively what we want to do about them, right? You can identify problems always. It's the question of figuring out what you're going to do with them and setting priorities and figuring out, again, how you're going to address them and who's going to do what. So the discussion papers that we've been working on, it's one discussion paper, but identifies all the issues and all the potential. Of note, because this is a watershed plan, and while we operate structures and like, as I pointed out, municipalities have a huge amount of control and influence about what happens on the landscape. You are where the pedal hits the metal, as it were, in terms of land development and the like, right? So there's a role not just for MVCA in implementing the watershed plan, but also for the local municipalities as well as the province and others. So the discussion paper identifies what all of us are doing today as well as potentially what we could do in the future either differently or stop doing. You know, there's no reason why if you've been doing something for 10 years, if it's not achieving results, why would you continue to do it, right? So we're taking a critical look at programs that we deliver and looking for opportunities either to continue, improve, or try something different. So the discussion paper will have things identified that municipalities could contemplate doing. And our goal is to engage the public and municipalities in that discussion later this fall once it's completed and over the winter months, and based upon the feedback we receive, to actually draft the watershed plan and table it to the board sometime next spring. So there's going to be a fairly extensive engagement program, but I'll look to Ken and others to see how you guys have been engaging the public throughout COVID, because I think we'll need to look at corporate leaders and how you've been doing that to make sure that we do it well. So that's it. I'm happy to take any questions.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Sally. Are there any questions or comments from council? Council Maiden.
Thanks for your presentation. It was really interesting. I have a question about the three-year plan, which I think is a good way to go to have a multi-year plan that sort of municipalities will kind of see what's coming, what they need to contribute, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And do you think it will provide a more firm commitment to funding from funding sources like the province and municipalities?
What I think it will do is have, well, notionally, and we're going to talk about this at the ward, is maybe a plan A and plan B, with and without provincial funding. The thing about assets, and you know this, is you can put it off till next year, or next year, or next year. But at a certain point, you have to do it, right? And our dams are no different. So what I've been talking to our director of engineering about is, you know, potentially we'll identify windows. And during those windows, we're going to hope we're going to get our provincial funding, right? But if we don't, what we're looking at is a potentially implementing a financing strategy that would help to defray the costs over 25 years, right? And that would show up in those plans.
Okay, now we're kind of familiar with those kind of 25-year plans. But
yes.
My second question is, I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about maybe what we should be looking for in development proposals that would fit what you described as low-impact development?
Sure. So when you think about, typically, they're developing farmland, right? So let's say a 100-acre farm is getting developed. Right now, to the extent that it may or may not be tile-drained, you know, a lot of that rainfall is going right into the earth. Now we're putting in a municipal road that's asphalt, the same with the driveway asphalt. We're putting asphalt shingles on the roof, which has a footprint. Depending on how much of that lot is actually developed, you could be halving or reducing to a third the amount of landscape that's available to infiltrate. So now that all that rainfall that falls on that other two-thirds is going like that into the storm sewers, hitting your stormwater pond and or creek and heading into the Mississippi River. So number one is you want to maximize the amount of permeable landscape so that there's that opportunity for infiltration, right? Now you can do that through having in your zoning bylaws lot coverage parameters, and I imagine you already do, that says to people, the footprint of the house can't exceed a certain amount of the lot because you need the rest of the lot for literally stormwater management purposes. You can also start to require them to use techniques like permeable pavement. I'm a big proponent of roadside swales as opposed to storm sewers because swales, they slow the flow, right? You know, a roadside ditch is much more efficient at allowing for water to infiltrate than a storm sewer, which just basically hugely accelerates the rate of runoff. And encouraging, you know, not just front yard planting. You know, we typically make developers plant a tree. You see a tree, stick tree on every front lawn. Well, what about backyard trees? What about thinking about, you know, right from the get-go, putting in plantings to up that uptake of water? So that's just, you know, a few examples of things that can be done. But if you're looking for input on that, I know our planning staff would be happy to provide more information. Yeah.
Councillor Ferguson, I think I saw your hand go up.
Yes. Thank you again, Sally, for a presentation. On page 21, and you made reference to dams in the watershed.
Yeah.
And lower right,
yes,
it appears you were very fortunate in having the opportunity of installing box culverts as opposed to bridges. We've had difficulty having box culverts in our many bridges that we've had to install at a significant cost. Is it fortunate that you had that opportunity, or do you happen to know someone that would maybe give you an inside track there?
So you're talking about the picture in the upper right?
The bottom right, which is
so the
box
bottom
culvert.
Right is actually nowhere in our watershed. I got that out of the
book. Oh, okay.
Sorry
about that.
Yeah, no, that was just an example of a road cross section. So, no. Okay. We don't have any special pull, believe me.
Okay, thank you.
Deputy Mayor Minnelli.
Thank you, and thank you for your presentation. Just a couple of things. We are addressing infiltration with our sewer system a little bit, and sometimes with power outages, there's an overflow, but we've installed a generator, and we're doing all we can, as much as we can afford to do. And the main pumping station is at Gemmell Bay, so it's fairly close to the water there. That's the main pumping station that brings it up. And if it rains, say if you have a torrential rain on the whole area, like I know some controlling agents of water go directly into the river with no holding because we're right on the river. And does it take like 2 days for the water to come downstream, or does it take 3 days, or...
It is measured in days. It would depend on where in the watershed it fell and other conditions, but absolutely some of our dams are operated because we know, okay, if it's peaked here on the Mazenaw Dam, we can anticipate it at Carlton Place X number of days later. So it is measured in days.
Is that coordinated the whole year round?
Yes, it is. We're in constant contact with the other facility operators.
And thank you.
Yeah, pleasure.
Councillor Girard.
Thank you. To the chair, Sally. I was going to throw something at you that's totally opposite to what you're talking about, and that is the fact that we have municipal drains in Mississippi Mills that have not been looked at for 40, 50, 60, 70 years. When you're doing your evaluation and you're doing your watershed, are you taking into account that there are municipal drains, or that they're not actually, there's no water flowing from them? And what is going to happen if we do go in and actually start a process of proactively updating and upgrading what we have as our municipal drains right now?
Okay, so a couple of things there. Most of our floodplain mapping is based upon a combination of elevations as well as those strictures, so be they municipal, you know, impediments or other kind of dams on the road crossings and the like. We don't actually have mapping that indicates to us which properties have been drained, like tile drained, or we would have the map, obviously, of where all the municipal drains are, but I don't think we have up to date on when they were most recently, you know, re-engineered and dug out and maintained and the like. So I just have a point of clarification back to you. Did you ask about work on the drains or work on the tile drains?
My question was more with regards to the fact that we have drains, but they have not been actually looked at. When you're doing your new mapping system,
right?
Will that take into account that there are municipal drains, or are you just using it as what's currently happening? And if we as a municipality alter that, how much is that going to affect downstream from us?
Okay. So the other variable in doing floodplain mapping is we actually have flow monitors on the watershed where we take actual flows. So we reconcile what we know in terms of rainfall data with flows on the landscape. And the flows on the landscape will be a function of the drainage system. So to the extent that our data, historical data, represents current state, the floodplain mapping will also represent current state. So if the municipality goes in and does extensive work on municipal drains within the watershed, yes, it has the potential to impact flows, the rate of flow. It's not going to change the amount of water hitting the landscape, but it will absolutely affect the rate of runoff from the watershed. That is more likely to have localized impact than large-scale impact, but there could be cumulative impacts at key points in the watershed. I'd have to talk to the Director of Engineering some more on that, because it's a really good question. I'm just curious, within the former township areas, do you have any sense of how much of the land, what proportion is municipally drained? Is most of it drained through municipal drains? Do you know?
I believe, looking at our mapping, I'm going to say mostly on the west side, there's obviously Mississippi Mills has the Mississippi going through it, but we have higher elevations and more water on this side of the Mississippi. I think based on what I've seen with our drainage maps, there's going to be areas that will affect more going down river than, like, yes, there's one of the municipal drains that goes into the Mississippi Lake, but majority of them go into Mississippi River and coming down this way, so it's going to affect further
down. Yeah, and we can
down.
See on that profile that, you know, there's a huge drop between here and the outlet to the Ottawa River. That water's going. And because of the drop in elevation, there aren't a huge, I mean, you can see at the very, you have areas of flat, which represent floodplain, right? So anywhere where you see it kind of flattening is where the water is coming down and then it's going out, and then it's going down and then it's coming out, right? So, and those drops are rapids and the like, right? So rapids and then plain. So yes, those areas downstream, which are mainly also farmland, right, are probably could see quicker flooding of their properties. But because of the continued drop in elevation, you know, I don't know that it would have a huge impact on ultimately on our floodplain mapping, but it's something to be considered. I'll take it back to our director.
My question is, when there was a large communication going on with regards to Enerdo updating the dam in Almont, there was conversation that what happened at Appleton would actually alter a lot what happened in Almont, though I never understood why when Appleton has quite a drop, like for the water to go down. I'm thinking there's probably 7-8 drains, municipal drains, that literally fall from Appleton to almost Blakeney. Okay. So I'm thinking, I'm just wondering how that's going to affect the waterways. Like, I don't think there's not really flooding from, the elevation. There's no really flooding happening below Almont.
No, because I'm looking at the profile view and there is a huge drop. Like, even if it's entering, there's not a whole lot of floodplain there. So yes, between Appleton and Almont, but then there's a huge elevation change there.
So
right?
us altering our ditches or our municipal drains is not going to affect the flooding.
That's where I'm going to talk to our director, because I'm not the engineer in the room.
Okay. All right. I'm just curious, because that's something that I would like to see something happening with our municipal drains. So that's something that I feel that it has to be thought about before we start.
No, I think that it's an excellent question, and honestly, I hadn't put my mind to it previously, so I will definitely ask him about that, and maybe we can come back to you in a few months' time with a bit of an answer to that.
Thank you.
Were there any other questions or comments while we have Sally with us? All right, seeing not, I thank you very much for your presentation and for answering all our questions. And I would look for a mover and seconder for the recommendation that the delegation by Sally McIntyre, MVCA General Manager, regarding the updates on MVCA activities be received by Council. Councillor Holmes and Councillor Dalgety, all in favour? Thank you. And thank you again, Sally. So we're on to section L, which is the Committee of the Whole report. There's four items on that report. L2, Councillor Gerard?
I was just going to
I just got to point out that the clerk is actually trying to get your attention.
Yes, I was just going to say that there's an info list item that's not on this list, so there's actually five items. And if you look at the Committee of the Whole report on page 27 of the agenda, it's the information about the North Lanark Historical Society.
Yep. So would we call that L5, I guess?
Yes.
Okay.
It's just that one item there.
Perfect. Thanks for drawing that to my attention. All right, so we have five items. L2, I'm going to suggest we pull for just a little discussion. Councilor Girard, I understand you want L4 pulled for separate voting. Any other of those items anyone wish to have pulled for separate discussion or voting?
Can I pull L5 too?
Yep. So L5, anything else? Okay, so in that case, I'm looking for a mover and seconder for L1. Councillor Holmes?
The Appleton Museum, did you?
That's L5.
Yeah, I'm going to have to excuse myself for that one.
Sure. So the clerk has note of that. Okay. So for L1 and L3, so L1 being parking restrictions on Rosamond Street and Mary, and L3 is regarding the fire protection agreement with Lanark Highlands. I'm looking for a mover and seconder to approve these two items. Deputy Mayor Minnelli, Councillor Maiden, any discussion on L1 or L3?
Just a discussion.
I talked with some of the guys in the fire department and chief, and they thought that it wasn't a huge deal to supply the reciprocal aid, so it's a good thing we got the resources to be able to help our neighbors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks, Deputy Mayor. Any further comments on L1 or L3? Seeing not, all in favor? Thank you. So we'll just go in chronological order here. So for L2, this is regarding the stop sign installation on Sadler and Horton and Sadler and Honeybourne. I just wanted to draw to council's attention that there is a policy regarding stop sign installation. In this case, that policy, it's rather out of date, so it wasn't considered when this came forward to council. So just speaking with staff, there would be an updated policy that'll be brought forward for our consideration, particularly because pedestrian safety and speed on the roads and whatnot is of particular interest right now in the community, and this may come through the community safety planning, which is part of our strategic plan. So I just wanted to draw council's attention to that. No reason to hold up this decision, but just know that there is a policy, it is out of date, and we'll be seeing something at a future time. Was there anything you might want to add to that, CEO Kelly? It's okay. Councillor Maiden?
Should we add to it a motion to review the outdated policy? Or is that going to be done anyway?
Yeah, we've already discussed that with staff. We can have it listed as an action item, I suppose, unless you want to have a motion attached to it, but it's been discussed with a few staff members. So is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a mover and seconder then for L3? Councillor Dalgety and Councillor Maiden are Elmont councillors. Any further discussion? I said L3. I meant L2. Excuse me. L2. Councillor Dalgety and Councillor Maiden, any further discussion on this one? Okay, seeing not, all in favor? Thank you. So that brings us to L4, which is the application for tile loan, which Councillor Girard wishes to abstain from. And I understand there's further wording that clerk will provide for us on this item as well.
Yes, so I spoke with representatives from the Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Rural Affairs earlier today, and they recommended adding on the, and that first piece of the recommendation after Pakenham, Ontario, they recommended adding pending funding from the Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Rural Affairs. The reason they are recommending that municipalities do that is in case they decide to end the tile loan program by adding that in. It doesn't leave the municipality on the hook for the full loan amount. They don't think there's any risk of it being terminated at this stage, but it's just something to protect municipalities.
Okay.
So the first motion would read, council approve the tile loan in the amount of $50,000 for Richard and Charles Gillen, or Richard Charles Gillen and Jennifer Mary Gillen of 1133 12th Concession South, Pakenham, Ontario, pending funding from the Ministry of Agriculture, Food, and Rural Affairs, and furthermore, that council directs staff to bring forward the necessary rating bylaw.
Okay, is that clear for everybody? Okay. Is there a mover and seconder for this item, L4? Councillor Ferguson, Councillor Holmes, any further discussion or clarification on the change to the motion? Okay, seeing not, all in favor? Thank you. You can come on back, Councillor Girard. And then item L5. This is the item regarding the North Lanark Historical Society for the roof shingle replacement. Councillor Holmes has identified that she has a conflict with this item. And the recommendation is that staff review the request by the North Lanark Historical Society for $13,500 for roof replacement work. Is there a mover and seconder for this recommendation? Councillor Maiden? Councillor Dalgety? Any discussion? Councillor Maiden?
I'm just wondering if this might be appropriate to discuss further at the budget considerations for this year. I don't know what anyone else thinks about it, but.
Perhaps we could have the staff report come forward at that time.
Yeah, because I'm wondering if this is the type of thing, like particularly with museums, you know, I know we fund a fair bit to several museums in the area. And is this in line with the funding that we provide to other ones? And perhaps staff could bring back a report on it? So unless staff knows at the moment.
I think that's what this would capture, the staff review of the request, because there is, and we can ensure that that is the case, that what you're identifying would be included. There is a formula that's used for funding to the museums. So I think that would probably be part of the review that comes to us. Councillor Girard?
Sorry, once again, I'm just pointing out the clerk's trying to get your attention.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Girard.
Councillor Harfield, oh my gosh. Madam Clerk.
Well, promotion there. I just wanted to say that the budget is going to be released this Thursday in the agenda. So that really only gives staff a day to get this staff report if you wanted it in the budget. So realistically, it may not be included in the first draft. Just wanted to flag that.
Okay, thank you for that. Did you have a comment yourself, Councillor Girard?
Actually, I wanted to bring up something that we discussed on Thursday when we had Mr. O'Toole.
O'Connor?
Oh, yeah, coming in and speaking to us. And he mentioned something about what the City of Ottawa does with regards to council getting together and having meetings and being able to speak to the public. And I'm disappointed we don't actually have anything similar to that. So we as a group don't have a chance to sit and discuss things like this. And I think this would be a prime example of something that we could discuss as a conversation. We could actually have meetings that we could talk about some of these items in as councillors, just having the conversation instead of not having it just being set off to for the staff to look after. Like if there's something that we as a council can discuss and then give direction to staff instead of just it not having it never coming back in front of us, I guess. I'm unsure how we can do that better because I've been disappointed with how we've been doing it to this time.
So that we're a little off topic with what is in front of us just right now, but I understand how you're seeing it connected to this issue. I think I think a possibility would be to reach out to the clerk in the, and correct me if I'm misspeaking here, but if I'm remembering correctly, in the communications plan, there was an opportunity to work with staff and having like constituent hours and whatnot as council members. That may be a place to start. Am I calling it the right thing? Was it in the comms plan?
It was either in the comms plan or the most recent, or in the procedural bylaw review.
Oh, maybe that's where it was, yes.
Pre-COVID, we were going to try to do ward meetings. Obviously, because of COVID, that was put on a bit of a back burner. But it's definitely, I know, I remember on in Ottawa, since they are very focused on wards, the councillors, they do have ward meetings. But I'm not sure if you're referring to having like the working groups of councillors come up with, is that more what you're thinking than the public consultation?
I forget which slide that he put up, but he showed it as there was one level of council meetings, and then there was different committees, but the committees were made up of councillors.
Through the chair, they had council as their top approving body, and then underneath they had three standing committees. And underneath the standing committees, they had their advisory committees. So if you want to, so their standing committees would operate very much like our committee of the whole. The difference, the large difference, is that at their standing committee level, not all of the members of council sit on those committees. So it's only a portion of their council that sits on a specific standing committee, just because there's so many of them. And then the standing committee would make a recommendation up to council for final approval. So that it would be very similar to our committee of the whole, where we debate items at the committee level and then we recommend up to council. But again, that's, yeah.
I guess I was thinking more along what he had said was, I believe they had a 3-day meeting going with one of the standing committees that they just got the public was allowed to come in and speak. So they had 3 days of public interaction.
So I think we're pretty far off topic on this one specifically. Maybe what I can suggest, if you want to reach out to the clerk, pardon me for getting your title wrong earlier, but perhaps if you want to have some discussion with the clerk on some of these communication ideas, it's certainly Mr. O'Connor's topic or conversation really got some topics in my mind that I'm thinking about as well. But I don't think that we can change our policies on communication and whatnot on this specific information item. If there's something that we can put together and have a discussion on this item at another time, that might make some sense. But I think we need to stick with what is the topic in front of us just right now. And Councillor Dalgety, you've been very patient waving at me if you want to go ahead.
I was just looking for clarity, the same thing. So we're being asked to approve staff review this request, and that's it.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, and as I had mentioned to Councillor Maiden's comment, there is a formula that was based on a museum study a number of years ago. So I would imagine, or we can ensure through direction or action, that part of that staff review would educate us on how the museum funding formula works and how replacement capital works might fit into that or not. Was there any other discussion on this motion? No? I can't remember if I had a mover and seconder. I think I do, eh?
Yeah.
Oh, perfect. Okay. So if there's no further discussion on item L5, I'll ask all those in favor of having staff review the request and provide information to us. Perfect. Thank you. That is carried. You're welcome to come back, Councillor Holmes. And I'll let you get settled. So we just have the two bylaws this evening, One is for the no parking signs on Rosamond Street and Mary Street, and the second is for the stop signs on Sadler and Horton and Sadler at Honeybourne. Would anyone like to discuss either of these bylaws separately? Deputy Mayor Minnelli?
You talked about the stop signs on Sadler and Horton. Are we going to pull them, or are we going to vote on that as a motion, or?
I pulled it, and I just provided a little bit of information about the outdated policy and that it's going to be coming back to us.
Okay.
If it's the wish of council to hold this up so that it goes through the policy, we can, but I don't think that that's probably the will of council. If anyone wants to pull it and show me otherwise, we can.
If council's okay with it, I'm okay with
it
too.
Okay. So is there either of these items that anyone wishes to have separate vote on? Okay, seeing not, I'm looking for a mover and seconder then for these two bylaws, M1 and M2. Councillor Delgatty and Councillor Holmes, further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor? Thank you. So those two bylaws pass. Which brings us to announcements and invitations. Are there any announcements or invitations anyone would like to share? So just one I will mention to everyone, and it's regarding the Federation of Canadian Municipalities elections. We're all entitled to vote in that election as a member municipality. The deadline to register to vote has been extended to the 18th. The election itself is October 5th to 7th, so I just draw your attention to that. Any further announcements or invitations? Going once, going twice? Okay. Mover and seconder for confirmatory bylaw, which confirms the proceedings of the council meeting. Deputy Mayor Minnelli, Councillor Ferguson, all in favor? Thank you. And adjournment, mover and seconder for adjournment. Councillor Delgatty, Councillor Maiden, all in favor? Thank you. We're adjourned.